call the Judiciary Committee meeting to order. And my apologies for running late. And as we entered into the last third of the session, I have a feeling we will get pushed from time to time. And that happened to us today. So it's about 2 minutes at 3 minutes after two. And because of the schedule, we're not going to hear SJR 9 today. So with us today is Senator Wilkowski, the Vice Chair, Senator McGuire, Wingman, Senator Dyson, Senator Caudill, Chairman. Today, what I thought we would do is we would go ahead and do the confirmation hearings. We have the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar and Commission on Judicial Conduct before us. Then we will go from there to some questions, answers, I'm sorry, of questions that came up under Senate Bill 49. The commissioner will come and give us a few minutes of answers and maybe a couple questions. And then Senate Joint Resolution number 9 will come up on Friday. So with that, anything from the committee to get started on? On the off-net, I have William Gordon and Robert Grossclose. William Gordon is being appointed to the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar. William, can you hear us? We may have overstayed our welcome. How about Robert Grossclose? Can you hear us?
Senator Cargill, this is Bill Gordon. Can you hear me?
Bill, thank you for hanging on, and my apologies for running the committee late today. Thanks for calling in, though. Why don't you go ahead and just state your name for the record, the board that you've been appointed to, and why you would enjoy working on the Board of Governors of Alaska Bar.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and to you and the members of the committee for allowing me to be heard. The short version, I guess, of my interest is twofold. First, I guess, as a consumer of legal services over the years, I certainly had an interest in the affairs of the bar, but more so through knowledge gained by my recent six-year term serving as a member of the Alaska Judicial Council. During that time, it allowed me the opportunity to interview literally hundreds of the top attorneys in the state, and I got to know them pretty well. And they put themselves through what is often a very difficult selection process, and so we spent a I'm getting some kind of feedback. Are you still hearing me?
Yeah, I can hear you fine. I heard you drop off for a second.
Okay. Well, I'll try to. I'll continue. I learned a lot in those interviews about the unique profession that they've chosen, the rules they have to live by, and also even some of the frustrations of their jobs. And I hope I can bring my experience both in the public and the private sector to the role that I would serve as a public member of the Board of Governors and be effective because of this experience. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I've lived here mostly in Fairbanks, but I've served time in Juneau and in Anchorage, and I've been to practically every rural village and community out there, so I have a pretty good knowledge of the state and its people and some of their concerns too, which I'm happy to bring to the board's attention should the need arise. So I hope you'll find my qualifications. I think you have a resume. It was actually submitted when I was encouraged to seek a position on the Judicial Qualifications Commission, but there wasn't a vacancy, so people asked me if I would take a vacancy on the Board of Governors instead, and I'm happy to do so, and I found it very interesting for the two meetings I've attended.
Well, first of all, accept my gratitude for willingness to serve. Is there any questions from the... by the way, I have Senator Olson that showed up. Thank you, Senator, for showing up.
Mr. Chairman.
This we have Bill Gordon on, who has been nominated to, or actually appointed to, the Board of Governors of the Alaska Bar Association. Anytime you want to pick on a bar association, now's the time, ladies and gentlemen. I think one of the things, Bill, that we have here in Juneau is a willingness to pick on the bar association. So, Senator Wilkowski.
I think I've found that both in my experience as a member of the Judicial Council, that we had some times that we had some contentious issues, and I'm sure that's going to be the same with the Bar Association, too. But I can tell you, you know, I'm quite a conservative fellow myself, and the reputation of the bar is sometimes somewhat liberal, but I found the people that I've interviewed to work with are very open-minded and really have the state's best interests, especially in the area of judicial appointments. I've been remarkably happy in my experience with those people. Coming with sort of a prejudiced viewpoint as a conservative before them many times, but it hasn't changed my philosophy at all, but it certainly has changed my my appreciation for the difficult circumstances they often find themselves in when they encounter the judicial process and the legal process in general.
I can only say that I relate. That's been my experience coming into the legislature. Senator Wilkowski has a comment or question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for the record, I'm a member of the Alaska Bar, and I just want to put that on the record. I don't know if that disqualifies me from ultimately voting in the end, but I did just want to disclose that. I want to thank Mr. Gordon for volunteering, putting his name forward, and also Mr. Grossclose. I know it's sometimes a thankless job, but we can't run the state without volunteers, and appreciate you putting yourself forward. And there's been some bills over the years, as I'm sure you've been aware, to cut the funding for the bar. There's a few bills this year. I haven't followed them real closely, but could you just give maybe your philosophy on what sort of changes you think we need within the Bar Association, and the interaction with the state legislature hasn't been the greatest over the years. Do you see any big changes that we need on the horizon, or do you have any comment?
Well,
on
thank you, Senator, for asking that question. And through the chair, I do have a couple comments on that. Like I say, I've only served for two meetings, but I found it quite interesting, having some experience with the Executive Budget Act during my time with Governor Hammond. The Bar Association really, it's a licensing agency, but it kind of operates, it's a sub-state created by statute that operates pretty much outside the Executive Budget Act. Because, you know, all its revenues are generated by its members, and its budget is, it sets its own budget and hires its own staff and operates that way. And as the Board of Governors, we need to be quite wary of the costs that are passed on to the members through our own activity. But because it's statutorily created, and it answers directly to the Supreme Court, it's kind of put in a precarious position of traveling between not only the executive, but the legislative branch and the court system. So we're sort of a stepchild of both, and I've noticed with curiosity that they're in the middle of a sunset review right now, and I asked, well, you know, my goodness, why? You know, I mean, what possibly could be any reason for not having the Bar Association? And you know, since there aren't state dollars involved, and even the personnel system isn't involved, it's kind of a different kind of thing that I'm used to. So I'm still trying to figure that one out. In regard to your question, I don't have a position, but I do find it curious that we've gone to the expense, I think, in the last 4 years, each year, of preparing for sunset review, when this is probably one of the few statutory created agencies that, you know, I can't imagine a possibility where that might happen, although the sunset review process is a good process by which for the legislature to speak to the bar about its concerns about issues, and that's fine, too. So, but I think we may be able to do that a little less frequently, which saves some expense not only of Legislative Affairs Agency, but also of the bar itself. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you.
And I think that was a good overview for those of us who sit on the committee. And not being a member of the Bar Association, it is a little mysterious to many of us in the legislature, knowing that it is statutorily created in the executive branch, appointed by the courts, are answerable to the courts. So, yes, thank you. That was a good overview. Is there any other questions to Mr. Gordon? What I would like to do is ask if there's any objection to moving his name forward to the full body for recommendation, confirmation, for confirmation without the recommendation. Mr. Gordon, thank you very much. The committee is going to move your name forward to the full body for their consideration.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate you taking the time to answer questions and be before us. Have a pleasant rest of the day.
All right, thank you. You too.
Bye-bye. We also have Robert Grossclos, I think, online. Robert, are you there?
I am.
Thank you for calling in, and please accept my apology for running the committee a little bit late. We're on legislative time right now, and that is flexible, I'm sorry to say. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and why it would be something that you would choose to do to serve on the Commission on Judicial Conduct.
Well, thank you, and members of the committee. My name is Robert Grossclos. I go by Bob. I was born here in Fairbanks many years ago, grew up here, attended college out of state, worked out of state, spent a year in Europe, came back in 1976, or actually late 75, and have been admitted to practice in Alaska since May of 1976. I've been in the private practice ever since then. I did a little bit of a court clerkship in 74 while I was still in law school, but my focus over the past 37 years has been in working as a private practitioner focused on the variety of cases that the general public brings to the firm that I'm affiliated with, and that is Cook, Schumann, and Grossclos. I've got five other law partners, and we have been in various forms and configurations working here in the interior for many decades. I have served in various capacities on the bar and with the Bar Association, Civil Rules Committee, Fee Arbitration, Fee Attorney Grievance Committees. In between 2000 and 2006, I had the honor and privilege of working with the Alaska Judicial Council as an attorney member of that group. In fact, I overlapped for a number of years with Bill Gordon, who you just heard from. And it is much the same as I think Bill described in his comments. The quality of judging in our state bears a very direct relationship to the nature and quality of justice as it is dispensed through our court system. And and my same interest in assuring the quality of judging in the state has, you know, caused me, when I heard that Mr. Ashenbrenner would be serving out his term on the Judicial Conduct Commission, to put my name forward to do what I can to serve with that body. And I'd be happy to so serve, and would welcome any questions the committee might have, or otherwise I would welcome your confirmation so I can go forward. I think the first meeting that I'm to attend is April 26th, so I'm looking forward to that.
For me, as an interior guy, first of all, thank you for the work you do up there in the interior and your willingness to serve on this board. Is there any questions from the committee at this point? One of the questions, Bob, that I would have is, what are some of the criteria in watching a judge that may be under some question for conduct? What can you tell me what some of that process is?
Well, the process is it starts with a complaint process, and that can be a complaint that comes from any public source or private source for that matter, and the commission is staffed rather frugally with its executive director and I believe one administrative assistant, and that complaint is then goes through an investigation process, and this is all according to rules that under the court, Alaska court rule book and through Alaska statute, essentially provides a due process mechanism by which judges that are the subject of an accusation or of a complaint can respond, and either the matter is then resolved, or if it requires hearing, it's then heard by the commission, and the commissioners, in effect, can either serve as the panel, the arbitration panel, or through an appointed master, and they don't themselves have the final say. In effect, everything is subject to the Supreme Court oversight, and the nature of the outcome is typical, I guess, of any type of occupational setting where a charge or claim of deficiency in office is explored and resolved, and judges are even though the state does its very best in through its selection process to assure that it picks the best, and I think the track record of as few judges as we've had that have had to go through some form of performance review and disciplinary resolution, you know, speaks to the quality by which the selection process has worked. But as a safety valve to that, and certainly who might make it for a very good judge, and a few decades ago, over the passage of time, no one's immune from physical disability, which is also kind of incorporated within judicial performance, that if there's a mental or physical reason to call a judge's performance into question, then that's also explored. I think that kind of encapsulates the process, as I understand it anyway.
And so one other question for me, Bob, is does that goes from magistrates on the Supreme Court, or what are the limitations of this particular commission?
My understanding is it's strictly the judges, and magistrates, I believe, are processed through, since they're appointed by the presiding judge of the district in which the magistrate serves. I do not understand our role as to be encompassing magistrates.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. That's helpful to me.
I'm kind of a newbie at this. I could be proven wrong on that.
Well, I'm learning my way through this. Any other questions for Mr. Grossclose? I would accept the motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move on to the full body, the name of Robert Grossclose, as a member of the Commission on Judicial Conduct with individual recommendations on to the full body.
Thank you very much. Any objection? Without any objection, thank you for the motion. We'll move this recommendation on to the full body. Bob, thank you very much for taking the time out. I tried really hard to think of how I could keep you online another 10 minutes. But I couldn't do it. So,
well, thank you, Chairman Coghill. Keep up, and may your committee keep up its good work and finish out the session with good fortune, as I'm sure you will.
Thank you for your service. Thank you, and have a pleasant day.
Okay, so thank you.
For those who came to the committee meeting after gaveling in, it's not my intention to bring up SJR 9, the constitutional amendment for education funding, today. We will let the introduction happen on Friday. House Senate Bill 49, we will take amendments on Friday with the intention of voting. But one of the questions that came forward the last go-around was to have the commissioner of Health and Social Services come before us to answer some of the questions that were asked by Senator McGuire and maybe a couple questions that we have from Senator Wilikowski. So at this point, I would like to open that discussion on Senate Bill 49. Commissioner, why don't you come on forward? My intention is to keep it as concise as we can, but at the same time, I want to get some as clear answers as we can. So thank you very much. And I know that Senator McGuire, you had the questions. Have you been able to get those questions and have a response from the commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, I have.
Why don't you just identify yourself and share with us what these answers look like.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Struer. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services. Senator McGuire, I'd ask that if I haven't captured your questions correctly, to please put me on the right track. First one is, how are adoptions playing out? What's it look like for the future? Are the numbers going up? Are the numbers remaining consistent? Numbers going down? The only numbers I have at this point, because we've attempted to get some consolidated numbers on adoptions in Alaska, but that's a very hard number to obtain. The only numbers I have are those through OCS. And OCS is usually indicative of where we are going statewide. And I can say that the numbers are remaining fairly flat. For 2011, there are 329 adoptions. 2012, there are 316. And that's about the swing that we're getting from year to year to year. The more successful we are in reunification, the less success we have in terms of increased adoptions. So reunification is the charge for OCS, and it's the direction that we work toward with all our kids that we have in custody. I've asked for the committee's indulgence on being able to continue to research to try to find out the total number of adoptions in the state if we can. And it may end up that we contact the five adoption agencies that operate in Alaska and try to work through them.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And on that point, I really appreciate it. And as you go through, I'll just might have a couple comments. This is short notice, and so I would appreciate the follow-up and whenever you're ready to present to the committee. I think contacting the five adoption agencies is going to be critical, but I would like to have an overall look, because I agree OCS probably has a trend, but because of that reunification mission, it's a slightly different view. And what I'm looking more at is a woman who is in going through a pregnancy and made that determination that she does not want to carry that pregnancy to term, and then goes ahead and carries the pregnancy to term to give up for adoption that baby. So it's a slightly different scenario than the OCS scenario, where you've got children that are taken in out of homes where there's neglect and abuse. And so I'd like to see a little bit more data in terms of how we're doing for those adoptions and the others.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, when I looked at our numbers, I assumed that was the direction you were trying to go on, and so I started making calls, and I was not able to put it together in the short time that I took to gather the data. So,
and just get it to the chairman, and we'll make sure that the members get it.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Second question is, given the scenario of a woman who carries a baby to term and after birth decides to place the child for adoption, what are her avenues to
pursue? Commissioner, before we go on further, I think this point, I think Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me.
Just if you know, or maybe you can get it to us, I'd be curious about the in-state versus out-of-state adoptions. I think maybe that's what Senator McGuire is trying to get at. How many Alaskan children are being adopted versus how many kids are being brought into the state from outside, if that's possible to get that. And then, just, you know, out of curiosity as well, how is Alaska being impacted by the bill that passed in Russia where they banned adoptions? My understanding was there were quite a few that were coming to Alaska.
Yes.
So just it'd be some interesting information for the committee to weigh.
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, that's a deep dive, but I will attempt to get that information as well.
If you can.
All right, the next question.
The next question, and again, I apologize. Given the scenario of a woman who carries a baby to term and after birth decides to place a child for adoption, what are her avenues? There's about half a dozen agencies that work in Alaska on adoptions outside of the OCS system. Catholic Social Services in Anchorage based but works statewide. Fairbanks Resource Agency in Fairbanks. Fairbanks Counseling and Adoption in Fairbanks. LDS, Latter-day Saints, Family Services, they're based out of Renton, Washington, but work in Alaska, have rather deep penetration in Alaska. And the World Association for Parents and Children, based also out of Renton, but working in Alaska. So those are the agencies that we will be trying to work with to come up with the numbers. The Russian adoption one is one that has raised my curiosity, too, so we will attempt to get that.
Thank you.
For tribal members, many of the tribes assist with adoptions, and that's a whole different subject matter that we have in here.
Okay.
What is the status of the intermission nursery?
Yes.
That was a deep, way back old dive I had to do. The Sachs Intermission Crisis Nursery has been closed since 2003. And so we had to do a lot of research to find that. It's historically was an emergency group facility targeted for infants and young children for short placement only. And sort of like a timeout nursery. These placements largely came exclusively from OCS. However, they did provide some limited respite relief for young parents in particular, and for self-referrals. However, the facility by default ended up being overused and inappropriately used, reducing efforts to find relatives, using it as a drop-off facility, not really as respite. We worked with them over a year in an attempt to get practice to change, and it just increased our the workload both in the department and in the crisis center, and they closed down, as I said, in 2003. It is something that could be looked at again, but it would have to be a slightly different model than the old Sachs one was. So. Questions on that?
I think Senator Wilkowski had a question.
I don't know if it's on that. This is the appropriate, but a few years ago we passed some legislation allowing women to surrender their babies. And do you have any statistics on that or any problems that have arisen from that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I don't have the exact numbers. I know in my tenure, I believe there's been three where they've been surrendered to an emergency room, and they were largely older children, but I will get those numbers.
That was a safe haven for the
21 days.
21 days,
yes.
Right? Okay. Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thanks for helping us. Would you explain briefly what ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act, does, how it affects these questions and the problems that may have come with that?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I do have that information. And in terms of Native adoptions and the Federal Child Welfare Act, all cases determined to qualify, which are the bulk of our Alaska Native families, are treated special in that the state has a higher level of standard to meet and must provide active versus reasonable services along the entire continuum of child welfare. OCS is required under ICWA, Indian Child Welfare Act, to notify the child's tribe. Tribes may choose to intervene as a legal party to the case, or they may assert their jurisdiction over the proceedings. The Indian Child Welfare Act requires that for Native children eligible for enrollment as a tribal member, the tribe must be notified of a pending adoption. This is true for adoptions processed through the Office of Children's Services or through private adoptions. Tribal courts in Alaska may facilitate customary or cultural adoptions. These do not require legal relinquishment of parental rights and are legally similar to legal guardianship. This could be viewed as special treatment for Native adoptions. A cultural adoption, in essence, means the state provides a consent to the tribal court, who finalizes the process, and in these cases, the termination of the parental legal rights is not terminated. It's far different for us, and it's a challenge for us. If a Native mother chooses to give up in the tribal court system now, if a Native mother chooses to give up her infant for adoption, Native mothers must wait 10 days after signing over the power of attorney for the baby, physically giving the baby up, before they can sign the legal relinquishment paperwork, and they must sign the paperwork in front of a judge. This is different from non-Native mothers who do not have to sign in front of a judge and can sign the relinquishment paperwork immediately after the birth. And they don't have to wait 10 days after giving the baby up. So once the relinquishment paperwork is signed, there's another 10-day waiting period before the judge can finalize the relinquishment. This is true for both Native and non-Native mothers. Native mothers must sign a tribal notification waiver if they do not want their tribe to be notified of the adoption. If the mother's tribe is noticed of the adoption, the tribe may intervene and take over jurisdiction of the adoption. So it's a quite different process for us with regards to the, through ICWA.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thank you. I have a couple more questions. What happens in a situation that a woman wants to put her kid up for adoption and it is not obvious that this is a child covered by ICWA, and then the tribe decides to intervene and claim the child?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I would have to do a whole lot more research on that to be able to give you an answer, and I would have to depend on my capable legal counsel sitting in the back of the room to even verify that. So.
All right, and a follow-up.
Senator Dyson, yes.
Can the tribe reach past the formal adoption process to put a claim on a child?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Yeah, if the formal adoption has happened and the adoptive parents have custody of the child, and then the tribe finds out that they had a claim on the child under ICWA, is there any way that they can reach or put a claim on that child who's already gone through the legal adoption?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, I think once again I need to investigate that legally.
Yeah. And I don't really know. Does ICWA say that the child, the adoptive parent, has to be of that tribe or has to be classified as Indian?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, the way I'd respond to that is that I think that the tribal member, the tribe has first priority, and then it's other Native, and then it's non-Native.
Yeah.
And, options.
Okay. Yeah, the really ugly case I got involved in, the tribe, child had been with foster parents for a long time. They're well along in the process. Tribe intervened, and for whatever reason, the child was placed into custody and adopted by a Caucasian woman who had been initiated into the tribe. And that was troublesome. Not the least of it was the child had been with the foster parent, you know, for all of its 2 or 3 years, 2 years. The troubling. Please don't take my comments to be at all pejorative against the Native adoptions and priority. Well, don't spend a lot of time on it, right. But I'd like that information sometime.
Just to thank you, and through the chair, just Senator to redirect a little bit. If you just, as you continue through, the reason why I think you have those in your notes. My point was to look at what some of the barriers are to adoption in Alaska, and I think that's why you have those in your notes. And if I could just ask it as you come back into your notes, another follow-up that would be great from Will Dye, your trustee assistant back there, is my understanding is South Dakota has taken on this issue of ICWA in a good way to try and increase the number of adoptions within their state. And I say this because there are wonderful Alaska families that really, really want to adopt Alaskan babies and children. And we have had many of these stories come into our offices, and it's devastating. And they end up, as Senator Wilkowski is referring to, trying to adopt babies from Russia, which is now closed, Kazakhstan, other places, because they have had trouble, and ICWA has been one of these barriers. And again, it's an important protection for heritage and things, but I invite you to look at the South Dakota model. We're going to look at it too and see if there's some kind of a way to look at that and see if we can do a little better.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I'd be happy to look at it, because I just dealt in probably in the last year with two very, very sad cases, very similar to what Senator Dyson described, of where a foster family had finally decided to move ahead with adopting a child who they had in the home, and relatives were identified either out of state, but they were tribal members, and the child ended up going in that direction, so I'll be happy to investigate. What are the qualifications for Head Start? Was another one. I think I'm back on track. DHSS does not administer the Head Start program. That responsibility rests with DEED. There's a link that we can provide to the committee that describes eligibility requirements, but the very basic requirements are that children are at least 3 years of age, must be from low-income families, 10% may be from families that exceed the low-income guidelines but meet criteria that the program has established for enrollment. Additionally, most of the children in remote Alaska are eligible due to the poverty of access rule. Amendment to the Economic Opportunity Act of 1978. This amendment allows children from families with incomes higher than the established poverty level to attend Head Start when no other preschool options are available to them in their communities. And then early Head Start, I think you're aware of, is birth to three for children identified for that program. What are the safety nets that are available for women that keep their children? First one's WIC, Women and Children's Program, provides if the mother's pregnant or nursing or has a child under the age of five. Fathers, mothers, grandparents, foster parents, and other legal guardians can also get help for a child under five. It's nutrition assistance, it's a variety of programs, and what I'll do is I'll leave behind a sheet that describes those in more depth. Child care assistance, resource and referral for quality child care, and provide subsidies for mothers receiving assistance, families transitioning off of welfare, and low-income working families to assist them in mainstreaming back into productive work environment. The Alaska Temporary Assistance Program, temporary cash assistance and work support for families with kids under 18 years of age. That's a quick overview of them. The Commodity Food Supplemental Food Program is for pregnant, breastfeeding, and postpartum women, infant, and children up to 6 years of age. They can receive supplemental foods designed to address nutrient inadequacies, including nutrition education, but can't occur concurrently with WIC.
Senator Bulikowski.
Thank you, Commissioner. My understanding is there's some programs available through Medicaid for family planning, where Medicaid would pick up, I think, 90%, and then the state would pick up 10%. Have you looked at all into that?
Through the chair, Senator Bulikowski, that was one of the programs I was asking for before I left today, and was not able to come up with that. So there is family planning assistance through the Department of Public Health as well. And there is a wide variety of programs through Medicaid for both pregnant women and recent postpartum women in care.
And maybe you can get back to us if you don't know, but I think this is for family planning, for birth control, things of that nature. Is that something that your department has looked into at all, or do you plan to look into it? Because I think my understanding is it's administered through Denali Kid Care. I guess the state has the option of taking it or not, and
it's under Title 10, Senator. I think, isn't it? If I remember correctly, the family planning portion comes under Medicaid rules. Under Social Security Title 10, but it can be administered under Denali Kid Care, if I remember correctly.
I think that's, is it, that's something that you've looked into or plan on looking into?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we've been looking at every single option we can for young families in terms of family planning. We do have extensive services through the Department of Public Health, Division of Public Health, that are provided for that through the Women and Children Program and others. And in terms of Medicaid and Denali Kid Care, I'd be very surprised if we don't cover most of those services at this point. But I'm going to have to go back and research them further.
And we had also under some of our welfare programs, under the old TANF program and under the newer program, I think there's some family planning and preservation that was allowed some of those things. So there's a mingling of a variety of different monies that can end up at Denali Kid Care, Department of Health. So and they flow in probably based on programmatic approaches, I would think.
My last question.
Yes, your last, Senator McGuire.
And in wrap up, I guess my last question, you probably won't have an easy answer to this, but one last thought I'd like you to consider is how would a poor woman get access in an easy way to a list of the kinds of services and resources that you just gave to me today? Kind of a one-stop information resource. Because that's the kind of thing that it is so massive. This, you know, it, as a lawmaker, we're, you know, I'm asking you to do this, and thank you to bring to us all the lists of the places and the stops. But what an overwhelming place to be pregnant and trying to figure out where to go. And so I just asked you to consider that that would be something that you look into.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, when you talk about massive, every day I'm more amazed at how massive it is. But that is available. The Division of Public Assistance is a one-stop shop.
Okay.
Where they can access all those services. One of the discussions that we've had is how do we do a better job of getting that information out there? You know, that's potentially can drive up the numbers, but it also increases the access to those services. There are a wide range of services, and that range of services continues to expand. And one of the areas that we've been working with it throughout the department is breaking down those silos that we have in the various divisions, because if you look at some of the eight divisions in the department, were larger than many of the other departments. And so it's we need to break down those silos and provide better services. We need to connect the services of public health and our public health nursing better to Medicaid. We need to connect when someone comes into the Division of Public Assistance, we need to be able to look at enrolling them for all the services that they're available for and should be receiving, looking at the whole person rather than whether they're coming in today, they sign up for public assistance, tomorrow they sign up for Medicaid. Next day they sign up for TANF benefits. 2 days later they sign up for heating assistance and on and on and on. So we need to, as I said, begin looking at the whole person. And it's a hard slog, but I think it's something that we can and need to do.
I appreciate that. I just think, you know, it's, you know, those the gestational period is such a fragile period, and knowing that you have access to good foods and maternal health care and where to go, and I don't know if there are bus passes or transportation resources, but whatever the resources are, that woman wouldn't have to go to 17 spots to figure that out, that she could know what those resources were. So. Thank you.
Commissioner, we really appreciate you taking the time to come before the committee. Any other questions?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair. And I had asked the commissioner if he could address the talk a little bit about the regulation that was adopted, and can you talk a little bit about what prompted you to do that and the procedure you went through? And because this is the issue that's before us has actually been defined. They've
right.
defined medically necessary. Have gone through a pretty rigorous process. So maybe you can explain to the committee about that process and what you ultimately came up with.
Senator Wilkowski and members of the committee, through the chair, I The regulation was simply adding a new section to the regulation of health and social services and abortion payment conditions. What prompted it? Losing $500,000 every year out of my budget because of what I pay for abortions and attempting to get a better handle on it. But more importantly, is to make sure that the abortions that we are paying for are indeed abortions that meet the intent of the Supreme Court decision of 2002. And so we came up with a certificate, certification from a physician to allow for payment for abortions under the Medicaid program. And the for a physician or provider to be paid for an abortion in Alaska under Medicaid, they have to certify one of two areas. One, it meets the conditions of the Hyde Amendment. Two, that it doesn't meet conditions of the Hyde, but the abortion procedure is medically necessary. Printed name of recipient's attending physician and the signature of the physician only. So you can have a staff person at a clinic signing for it is physician attesting to the fact that the abortion was medically necessary. It does not get into defining medical necessity in any way, but it allows us and requires us to it allows us to track what we're required to track, and that's that Hyde procedures, which are reimbursable under federal guidelines, or non-Hyde, which are reimbursable under the 2002 decision. That's the form. I have a copy of the form I can leave with Karen for distribution if you'd like to have that.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, was this something that was open for public comment? Did you receive a lot of comments on this? Was this something that... talk a little bit about that.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, it was open for public comment. We did receive a lot of comments on it. A lot of the comments were not particularly constructive, but they were comments regarding access, denial of access, or increasing access. We did, Planned Parenthood did meet with us. We had a lively discussion multiple occasions, and came to an agreement that the form did meet the letter of the law as far as, well, we came to acceptance from them, agreement from me, that meaning the department, that we did meet the letter of the law of the Supreme Court decision.
Mr. Chair, does the new regulation permit doctors to perform abortions that are elective abortions?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, this does not address doctors' limits of practice. It only speaks to reimbursement for an elective abortion versus a medically necessary abortion through Medicaid.
And so could, for in order to get reimbursement from the department, would a doctor have to verify that it was medically necessary?
Through the chairs, Senator Wilkowski, yes, they do. I can read you, if you'd like, for the record, the two conditions, one of which they have to check to obtain reimbursement. The first one is, I certify, based on all the information available to me, that before performing the abortion procedure on the above patient, her pregnancy was the result of an act of rape or incest, or the abortion procedure on the above patient was performed due to physical disorder, physical injury, or physical illness, including a life endangering physical condition caused by or arising from the pregnancy itself, that would place the woman in danger of death unless an abortion was performed, which is Hyde. The second certification, if they don't meet that criteria, is I certify based on all the information available to me that the above does not apply, but the abortion procedure was medically necessary. Those are the two conditions to effect payment. For them to receive payment, one of those two conditions must be met and needs to be certified by the attending physician.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Have physicians been submitting the certificates, and is your department accepting them and making payments?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, the actual requirement is effective April 1. but there has already been some coming in.
Another topic, Mr. Chair, and this is something I've asked him.
Sure.
I told his legislators I would be asking about this. And in the proposed bill, there's a provision that says the department may not pay for abortion services unless the abortion services are for medically necessary abortion or the pregnancy was the result of rape or incest. And there was a witness the other day who raised the question of, well, who determines whether or not there's a rape or incest? And have you given thought to how you would make that determination?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I've given lots of thought to it. I have not formed any conclusion, nor am I going to before I have to deal with this in some form or manner.
Mr. Chair, if I could, do you have any provisions, other provisions in the statute regarding rape or incest? And I think for some of us who are going to be voting on that, that the issue of some outside person determining whether a rape or incest occurred could be very offensive to a lot of people. And I think that is important that we have at least some discussion, Mr. Chair. Who determines that? Would you be able to make that determination before we move this bill to the out of the committee or to the floor? Because I would certainly be interested, and I think as a senator who's going to be voting on this, I would want to know what the policy is. Who's determining whether? Are we going to start questioning women as to the specifics? Are we going to be reporting these rapes? I mean, how do you intend to enact that provision if we pass this bill?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I can't answer that question. I think that a lot of it's going to depend on Let's Legal. A lot of it's going to depend on my own department counsel taking a look at it once this bill moves further along. And also I think that there's a good possibility that it's ultimately going to be dealt with in the court should it go forward.
I will just say from my perspective, Senator, that the indication on the regulation of the doctor certification is probably going to be the way it'll have to go, because it will be that decision at that point. Because I don't know that you want necessarily a court or a law intervening in that particular case. So it just has to be that it was alleged rape, because there are going to be sometimes where unreported rape is going to be something that would be dealt with. And I would just probably head off in that direction. Senator McGuire.
I'd just like to say on the record that I would hope that we're not going to be expending state resources to investigate women and question those kinds of things and go on witch hunts. You know, that if a woman states to her doctor that she has been raped or has been sadly in a case of incest, that clearly that woman is speaking the truth.
Senator McGuire, through the chair, I right now the only investigation that we're doing is requiring the certification. I'm not going beyond that.
Senator Dyson, on this point.
Yeah, I'm going to say something that will make me, it must misunderstood, will make me more of a target for folks that think that men are all the villain in this. But as we close up the discussion, the description of what is medically necessary, there have been and there will be women who have realized they don't meet that. We'll say, I was raped, and and therefore the government needs to pay for it. I hope those are very rare. I only know of a couple, three in 25 years, but those things can go both ways. Unfortunately.
For me, one of the other fears is that you have those who provide abortion services kind of legally bringing in youngsters and then saying that it was certified as a rape and covering up those who are being abused. And that would be unfortunate if that ever happened. And so those are several of the sides to that question. But at that point, you have to let a doctor be the discerner at that point, because I don't know that anybody would be able to. And in all the discussion on whether we should get between the doctor or not is a legitimate discussion, but it's also a legitimate discussion that there are those that we feel are elective, and we just have not been able to define them to date. So that's what the attempt is. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there, do you know if there would be a requirement if a woman came in and said, I've been raped, or I've been the victim of incest, I don't want to report it for whatever reason. We know most rapes go unreported. Would there be a requirement, or do you intend to have there be a requirement for a doctor or your department to report that rape or incest to the authorities for investigation?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I can't speak to the requirements for a physician to report it, but I do not believe it's the department's responsibility to report it as a result of this form coming in or some other medical procedure.
To be fair, haven't we got mandatory reporting statutes on the books?
For doctors.
Yes, sir, we do.
Right. And so I think those are some of the things that are tougher decisions for almost anybody who is a mandatory reporter, whether they be a school employee or a doctor. But I think at this point, that reporting is important, because just for the fact that I said earlier, if somebody is continually being abused and can fly under the radar screen, being certified time and time and time again by a professional, that would be a most unfortunate circumstance for that young lady in this world.
Senator Coghill, through, I don't disagree with you, but at the point at which Medicaid sees or is informed of something like this, it's beyond third hand. And I would have to talk to counsel on that to determine our responsibility.
For us as policymakers, that's something that we would look at within the mandatory reporting requirements. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. And then, so again, looking at the bill, Section 1, do you envision creating a new form which says, which requires that, I guess you have one part where it says medically necessary, another part where it says victim of rape, another part victim of incest? And is that, do you envision having a reporting requirement like that, or how would your department deal with the rape or incest exclusion or inclusion, I guess?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I do not believe that this bill is going to supersede Hyde. Hyde would remain in there, and that's the rape or incest portion of the our form. If this bill comes into law and becomes the law of the state, we would have to amend the form to incorporate what this bill says. At this point, we have Hyde and we have the Supreme Court decision from the state of Alaska. And those are the two that we're basing our payments for abortion on. That answer your question, sir?
It does. And if I could, Mr. Chair, one last question.
Sure.
When you were enacting your regulation, you didn't go as far as we went in terms of defining what serious risk to the life or in defining what is medically necessary. And did you have legal counsel that advised you not to do that?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, we had legal counsel through this entire process. In terms of advising us not to do that, I do not believe they advised us not to do that. I pretty much is based on my feelings about medical necessity were that it was not defined in the Supreme Court decision, and we went with what the Supreme Court decision showed, and that's what our basis for payment was.
And I would only expect that that would be the case, that they would be under direction. And you know, though I think this refines that to some degree, I don't find it as an affront that some people do to that decision. But I think that this refines what they said
to show that there is a medical necessity and elective. They have referred to elective, but never did allude to what that might be. And so that's what we're trying to do here. So, any other questions?
Yeah, just one I just thought of.
You said last question.
Well, I meant it when I said it. This really will be the last one.
All right.
The issue of cost, do you have any sense of how much, because I expect this will be litigated if it passes. And I know the last time we passed something, it got litigated pretty heavily and went to the Supreme Court, and there were some pretty heavy costs involved. I imagine you don't have it off the top of your head, but perhaps you could get that to us at some point, what the costs were for the last litigation with Planned Parenthood, so we could get an idea of what we're looking at down the road, because I think there will be, for sure, fiscal impact here from litigating this.
And you might want to get that from the Department of Law, because I think they're the ones that probably have the fiscal impact of that more than the Department of Health and Social Services. On Friday, we'll bring this bill back up for us, any amendments. Also going to bring House Bill 69, which is exempt firearms from federal regulation, which has the issue of charging feds with felonies, and the constitutional amendment for education. So we have a busy day on Friday, and my expectation is to move through them deliberately, but not lingering. All right? With that, we're adjourned. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you.